I'm actually not going to say very much about my own work. I'm just going to more reflect on the sort of multidisciplinary and interdisciplinarity. And I have to say, this is really much my perspective on how this works and what works and what doesn't work. And so if I step on anybody's toes, I apologize in advance. I've worked in several interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary projects in the past, and this was one of them. And obviously, they're always very, very challenging. And I was in a workshop a few weeks ago, which was on valuing nature. Which somebody heard about this before, and we were asked specifically come up with suggestions as to how we can promote interdisciplinary working. And I think there was a general consensus that the only way this is going to work is if we put all the researchers in a room or in a hotel for a few days, lock the door behind them and leave them there until they have read all each other's work and come out with a general consensus as to what the topic is that they're actually researching. Now, we didn't do this in Resolve, but I think there were a lot of good attempts to go in that sort of direction. So we had lots of meetings. We did have discussions around some of the concepts. And for instance, one of the extensive discussions we had at the start of the project was about the concept of lifestyles. And lifestyles is in the title of Resolve. Scott did some really good work and trying to get everybody together and to talk about everybody's disciplinary perspective on what is a lifestyle. And I think the final conclusion was that there is no general consensus, because everybody works with these constraints within their own discipline, and it's really, really difficult to come to a general consensus and to think about how we all measure these concepts in a similar way. I made some notes, so I might jump around a little bit, but just to remind myself as to what I was going to say. One of the things I also remembered when I was a PhD student, I was in a multidisciplinary project, and I remember at the end of that project, we thought, well, it was all the co-investigators and the PIs' fault, because if they, all these big egos, had just sat in that room, we locked them up, then the researchers, the PhD students, wouldn't have had so many problems in trying to do something multidisciplinary. So maybe I should have remembered that when we started Resolve. My experiences with Resolve, and I think in general with interdisciplinary projects or multidisciplinary projects, and I think the terms are used interchangeably a lot, is that I think some things obviously did work really well, and some things didn't work so well, perhaps not as well as we had hoped. And there are obviously lots of reasons for that. I think one of the problems, of course, is that if you work in a multidisciplinary or an interdisciplinary project, you deal with lots of egos, and people know better in their own discipline. And so that makes it more difficult. And obviously, we started all in an interdisciplinary project, so the egos might have not been as strong as they are in other places, because at least there was a willingness to work together. And I think in some places it has worked really well. So I think in some of the projects that we've done in Resolve, looking at, for instance, the work we've done in a psychology project that looks at meat consumption, which very much sort of moved over the edge of psychology into sociology, and I think some of the work also that Justin did, which was in between psychology and sociology, which actually those projects worked really well, which I think is particularly interesting, because from my perspective, I think sometimes it's easier to work with a discipline that is way off your own discipline, probably because you don't step on each other's toes so much, so you're not in each other's way, and you can leave each other and respect each other's disciplines more easily. So working with somebody with a discipline that is actually closely linked to your own discipline can sometimes be much more difficult. So I think in that sense, there have been some really good, successful achievements in Resolve. Now, we all already heard a little bit this morning about the challenges that, the challenges that every researcher has in terms of the ref and the demands in their own discipline, and how we match that up with practical problems. And I think it's the same also with multidisciplinarity. It's working within the demands and the constraints, and we all know that, the demands and constraints of your own discipline, and actually matching that up with learning and understanding and talking to other people is really quite challenging. And I think what I've seen in not only Resolve, but in a lot of other projects, what sometimes tends to happen is that rather than people moving towards more multidisciplinarity in a project like this, sometimes people can actually become more monodisciplinary. So they actually become more and more focused on their own discipline because they start to distinguish themselves. Identity comes to mind here. I am a psychologist, and I become more and more of a psychologist because I contrast myself with sociologists, for instance. And not that everybody works that way, but it does. I think that's one of the things, one of the challenges that we're dealing with. And I think in terms of one of the particular most detailed challenges that in terms of multidisciplinarity is the sort of unit of analysis that we tend to work with. So, for instance, as a psychologist, we look at individuals. Pure psychology looks at what goes on in people's brains. And we look at maybe a little bit on the outside world, but then it's usually from the perspective of the individual brain and how they make sense of the world around them. Whereas, of course, if you look at the concept of sustainable lifestyles, it is massively complex. And actually, talking to people from the practical side and from other disciplines, different disciplines have different units of analysis looking at a community or a society as a whole or a policy instrument, that's really difficult to match up. And the disciplines that I think work together best are the ones that have the same unit of analysis. So whether it's an individual consumer behavior or a carbon footprint of an individual and an individual behavior, for instance, I think that's easier to match up there. So I'll just sort of draw this together. So one of the questions obviously is, do I think that Resolve was successful in terms of interdisciplinarity or multidisciplinarity? Obviously the question is yes. The answer is yes and no. In some places better than another. But I do think it's really important to make a distinction between interdisciplinarity and multidisciplinarity. And I think often, from my perspective, interdisciplinarity is perceived as something that is better than multidisciplinarity, because multidisciplinarity is the thing where people in different disciplines work together on the same issue and that's then pulled together into a sort of a general picture. Whereas interdisciplinarity, obviously, is actual people, individual researchers working across the boundaries of their own discipline. And I think for a project like Resolve, for probably lots of other projects, it is perhaps too challenging to ask maybe PhD students who are, after all, training in a discipline, or even young researchers who are developing a career in their own discipline, to ask them to not only do a discipline and train in their own discipline, but also to learn about lots of other disciplines. And maybe that's not necessarily the best way to go anyway. So maybe multidisciplinary projects where you actually have lots of people addressing the same problem from different perspectives is a really good way to go. And I think in that sense, Resolve was really, really successful because we had a lot of people willing to listen to each other, willing to talk to each other. But the most important and crucial element of a multidisciplinary project to work is that it really relies on having people that are then able to collate all this information and translate it into something that is useful for different disciplines and for policy. Obviously, we have Tim, we have Ian, who do these types of things. They are very experienced researchers, people who can do that. And I think that is sort of a project like Resolve is sort of reliant on people who can collate all that evidence. And that's what I wanted to say, really. So, who's next?
Super. Tracy, let's pick some of that up.
I wanted to actually give you an anecdote to illustrate some of the work and what it's like to work in an interdisciplinary research unit. So I wanted to start by talking to you a little bit about my own research, or the research that we've done, and some of the sociological work looking at sustainable tourism. But we worked deliberately when we were looking at tourism with a group of middle earners. That's quite a constrained income. So the highest householder in the house was earning between 17 and 27,000. We followed them for a year across a recessionary year, August 2009 to 2010, to have a look to see what happened to them, and also escalating fuel prices across that year, what happened to them, what happened to their leisure practices across that year. And so what we saw, having chosen exactly the right set of people to be quite impacted by this recession, and people who really were talking about how difficult it was with fuel prices, people who had had to give up things, people who had had to change their lifestyles through being priced out of certain aspects of their life or through economic insecurity, through losing bits of their job. And you know, so they'd lost bits of leisure, but they'd also had quite a difficult time with their lives, a few of the sample, and certainly by the time after a year, and when we were in the third interview with them, we were hearing people say, you know, okay, I'm losing these bits of leisure, but actually, you know, it's been awful, and I took to bed with a migraine for 2 days last week because I'm so worried about my finances, or, you know, this is the first time I'm 50 years old and I have children, and this is the first time I've ever struggled in my life, you know, and the rising fuel prices have got to the point where, you know, I'm having to give stuff up, and I've been really quite, you know, having really quite difficult impacts on their lives, and we're hearing quite difficult stuff back from them. So I presented some of these findings to the research unit in Resolve with our different disciplines, and Bronwyn talked to me about the gardening state and wanting people to be productive within a gardening state. One of the psychologists said to me, actually, what, you know, you've worked on a year-long time scale, but we know that after 5 years, people's sense of loss about losing things out of their lives, they become used to it, and it might not be so bad. So, you know, you're working on a time scale whereby maybe you haven't quite caught up the full implications of what this might mean for their lifestyles, the meaning of their lifestyles. One of the economists said, do you know what? I don't care. If they're being priced out of stuff, I don't care. As long as my job's done, as long as I've got people to have a lower carbon lifestyle. One of the economists talked to me about welfare state and about how, you know, government could fulfil its duty if people are priced out individually, of then replacing that with other aspects, because that's what welfare policies do. Then we have Tim, who obviously starts from a completely different place about thinking about a completely different economics, which has much more about equality as its starting point. All of which then has a lot of implications when thinking about our interdisciplinary nature. The first being, are we all talking about the same thing? You know, are we all talking about the same thing when we talk about sustainability and sustainable lifestyles? Because to me, if someone's saying, I don't care about whether there's any equality impacts going on, all I care about is pricing people out of their lifestyles, they're talking a different thing about sustainability to what I'm talking. You know, that's to me, sustainability has a social justice element to it. So there's, are we talking the same thing? But also, are those different perspectives all equal in terms of who pays them attention? You know, do some of them have more purchase out in the real world, out in policy? Do we then have to be able to deal with those, to understand them, to take them on board, to think about the sort of messages that we put out from our work? So is it well worth listening to them and trying to write some of those through as well in our research? You know, are we going to find different things from different methods? Because what does it mean in terms of who are we talking to about their different lifestyles? Are we talking to the same people in terms of other people who have been targeted by policies or indeed just rising fuel prices are targeted? Are they the people who we're following? Are they the same people who are the problem? And what might that mean for policy? But what time frames, as our psychologist friend pointed out to me, what time frames are we doing on that on? And how then do we get these methods in place that mean that we're capturing not just the short-term impacts, but the long-term impacts, to know what we should be addressing, what we shouldn't? In some ways, the interdisciplinarity brings a set of problems with it, because we're not sure we're all talking about the same things, and we all have different methods, and we all have different findings. And sometimes it brings some opportunities in terms of the fact that I've actually started to write through some of that when I'm writing out my findings, to actually work through some of those bits where I think it's worth working through, to actually think about where the different policy solutions are, which is quite hard because I don't know in depth all of those different areas. But it certainly seems to be well worth it when we're finding things where different disciplines, different people have different perspectives. Some of those are worth listening to, taking into account and working through, even if that sort of makes it quite hard. my short vignette to suggest a whole range of problems and difficulties and solutions and opportunities that come from our work.
Thank you very much. There's a lot of points of connection there, I think, with what Julie Neuberger was saying, and I'm sure we'll come back to some of that. Right, who's next? Justin.
I won't say too much, but I guess I want to start with asking, what does it mean to belong to any particular sort of discipline, really? You know, I'm a cultural geographer by trade, and I landed up on a project. I don't know, I'm not sure how Tim would describe himself. Is he an economist? I don't know, or is that some way sort of derogatory? but... on a project which was headed up by Tim, and then working with sociologists and psychologists, so some of which was more familiar than others. As a geographer, I kind of think I was more comfortable with the sociology side of things than the psychology side, and that was down to theoretical frameworks, my knowledge of the discipline that was there already, and in terms of the methods that were being used. I'm very much on the sort of qualitative side of research, and haven't done quantitative work for a while. So that also forms a bit of a barrier. But at the same time, as a cultural geographer, I think I'm quite undisciplined in the sense that, you know, theoretically, I've always felt able to say, okay, well, that piece of theory looks interesting, that method looks interesting. There are epistemological issues there, but I've always felt that I could kind of borrow from those to an extent. So this idea of working within a particular discipline doesn't necessarily ring true with me. I mean, the work that I've been doing required me not to become any kind of economist, but I certainly started reading up on the sociology of the economy in order to do the work that I was doing. So this idea that we're in a discipline and we can't move across boundaries doesn't necessarily ring true to me. To an extent, but of course there's different, you know, there's economists and there's economists, there's sociologists and there's sociologists, and sometimes I think we come up, particularly in terms of theoretical understandings, against big barriers, and I think the one that I found possibly was the difference between a post-structuralist account of the world against a structuralist account of the world, and how that kind of was sort of very much a barrier to kind of actually working with people. So the other thing that I wanted to say was sort of very much more mundane, in the sense that I think the actual geography of a research project in terms of where you're situated, even on a university campus, is actually important. The fact, you know, we as a project team were quite spread out around the campus, and I'm not necessarily sure that actually helped us. I think literally being in the same place and living on top of each other may have caused a few sort of arguments, but may have in the long term been quite a helpful thing. So that's quite a mundane aspect of it, but I think it's also important. But I think what I'd just like to end on is that there is a danger, I think, with the research councils now in particular, that they stipulate interdisciplinarity as a kind of, you know, you must have a team drawn from all these things, when actually that should be driven by the object of study. You know, does that actually require this? Because otherwise it just becomes a bit of a box-ticking exercise for me, which I'm not sure is entirely healthy. But, yeah, I won't say any more.
Great. Thanks so much, Justin. Right, Bronwyn.
I feel quite honoured to be asked to speak. Unfortunately, as they were laying the cable here, the water tipped all over my notes, so I've just recovered them. But coming as I do from months of natural disasters, including this week, I'm getting used to it. Certainly working out of a tent and working for a community in Christchurch, which is struggling, as I said in the earlier session this morning, with the biggest disaster in terms of an impact on a domestic economy of an OECD country since World War II. A small, forgotten provincial city that's struggling with a big problem, I've been thinking a lot about the value of research for communities. And it's humbling to have had to shift perspective from researcher to recipient, and also to suddenly realise that you're it, or we're it, that when things go wrong, actually we have to do something. And right now in New Zealand, in Christchurch, we're in the middle of just having to do stuff, and it's going to take us 5, 10, 15 years to recover the situation that we're in. So what are some of the tools and ideas that I can take from the work in Resolve, which has been really helpful, that might also resonate with some of the situations that you're facing? Because I do think, and said this morning, in my newfound role of dual citizenship, thank you very much to the United Kingdom, I do think that there are great similarities between earthquakes and the politics of austerity. And I do think that both have the potential to blight a generation. So what are the first things? There's sort of 8 points I'd just like to make very quickly. The first, I think, is philosopher Bonnie Honoig put it beautifully in her book Emergency Politics, which is kind of like the thinking woman's shock doctrine. She says that citizens need the tools to fight out of submission. And certainly living in a community at the moment where we've suspended the Constitution for 14 weeks and we have no democratic voice, it's been quite startling the effect that that has on a community who is law-abiding and suddenly silenced. And for a political scientist slash geographer, it's also really humbling that the first discipline that's useful is actually the arts and theatre. So you have a shut-down, locked-down centre city. And guess who helps? Gap Filler, a student theatre group that somehow manages to find and borrow controversial, interesting, stimulating and uplifting films for a community and critical theatre and ways of thinking and ways of imagining new possibilities in a situation in which so many of us have lost so many people we love and buildings and places we know. Secondly, I should probably say, and I should open this by saying, some of my best friends are social psychologists, but I think that politics, economics, and psychology are very colonizing disciplines. We have a very unfortunate habit of thinking that we can define the problem and pose the solutions. And I am currently, I admit, alarmed at the intellectual streams of thought which seek to unite individualistic psychology and behavioural economics, with the resulting unfortunate trend towards authoritarianism in our behavioural studies and the depoliticisation of our social practice research. I think that social psychology is very important. It's taught us lots. Right now, in the situation we're in, it's very helpful to understand grief and how a community might recover and might find some resources to recover, but it is not the legitimate basis for making public policy. So why is it that we've seen this remarkable growth and interest in behaviour studies? And I'd like to thank some of the people that I was even talking with here today this morning as I was thinking about this. I think there are a couple of reasons that we've seen a growth of interest in behaviouralism. One is that it seems to have, there's a fallacy that it's got low political cost. So it's really great for politicians because you can make decisions based on evidence, not on moral and hard political debate. There's also a fallacy that it's got low transaction costs. You know, wouldn't it be marvellous if all we have to do is paint rumble lines on the road and we effectively are getting to a greener vision of the future? And I think that that fallacy hides three difficult hidden costs. The first is the cost of democracy for the loss of public debate and public deliberation. And that's particularly important because, especially in a situation like we've just been through in an earthquake, when everything has changed, you then have to reconsider what the basis is of your common purpose and where you've got legitimacy to act. And if you haven't had the opportunity to have public debates that legitimate chosen courses of action, it's very hard to start them again. And I'm thinking about Michael Jacobs' concern that in the future, right when all the costs of oil, fuel, costs, climate change all hit together in the perfect storm, unless we've had the opportunities to really embed our debates about sustainability, then we won't have a basis for actually collective action. So there may be a high cost, an opportunity cost for democracy. There may be a political cost with a little p for politicians, because they're caught from the left and the right. The right hates the paternalism of the liberal nudging, and the left just hates being told what to do. But we particularly, but the left also is struggling with the loss of opportunity for deliberation. And the third, I think, is a social cost, which the Baroness referred to, of the loss of the opportunity to debate the ethics of what we're doing. I'd just also like, and very quickly in the last couple of points, to make points about things that have struck me as the practice take-homes that are not connected with the research. One is about the really important role of regulation. And I'm speaking here from a previous role as the Broadcasting Commissioner in New Zealand, and also as a role in watching Australian, New Zealand and Asian producers trying to sell into Europe. They actually don't really care about the sustainable behaviours of customers. They just want to know what the EU regulations are. And we thank you to the EU for your regulations, because they make a huge difference. That's not to say that it's not really important to understand the social context and how we live our lives, but regulations matter so much. I'd also like to make a point about the structure of public science and the way that I think it's doing our communities a disservice. It's so obvious at the moment in our situation in New Zealand. Our research groups are pitted against each other in competition for limited amounts of funding, so their point scoring on very small, often, points of principle. And I know we say that there is often nothing as vicious as university politics because there is so little at stake. But actually, it's really difficult when you have teams who are not collaborating on their research but constantly competing, and it becomes unhealthy. You lose that sense of yes, you get an edge, but you lose something. It also means, because the PBRF is driven, or your RAE, is driven around different objectives from community needs, then we're inundated at the moment with researchers who want to come and study us. And we think, well, we can study us. We actually want to know what's worked in your communities and how we can take those lessons. I think there is something wonderful about the new economics, the new sociology, the new politics, the new around the creations of public space. And I think, and I welcome and thank Resolve and also the Tyndall Centre at UEA for giving me this 3 years fellowship, because it's been an opportunity to take part in a public space about track two or alternative thinking, so that when our plan A fails, as it has so dramatically for us, we have something to offer a community, or offer our communities, the plan Bs and Cs. And I also welcome, my final point, the shifts towards integral thinking. I used to tease my colleagues that it seemed like science with yoga, but now I humbly recognise, from the basis of where we are down under, that nobody has the answers, and we're just grateful for people who will help us. Thank you.
Thank you. For... Thank you very much, Bronwyn. Just finally then, Prashant, as an outsider and an economist, they don't have to go together. Okay. Would you like to offer some reflections on what you've heard, and maybe also any points that struck you from this morning's?
Happy to. Thanks, Ian, for inviting me at very short notice like this. I actually work at Consumer Focus, but I think maybe for this audience it would be more useful for me to sort of reflect on my times as a consumer of research, because over the years I've spent quite a bit of time in Whitehall looking at analysis or commissioning analysis myself. So what I thought I'd do is actually offer a few vignettes of policy decisions I've been either close to or directly involved with, which actually made use of analysis, and just reflect on those for some of the kind of challenges you face. The first decision, I think, was one of the ones that came up in the discussion earlier this afternoon about the way that DEFRA reacted to beef, or rather the fact that we are eating too much of it and we should eat less of it. I think this actually arose as sort of a policy issue probably about 4 years ago, when Silso did some work which showed that emissions, greenhouse gas emissions from the life cycle, were about twice or thrice as much as chicken and pork. And I think I circulated the paper around sort of at the top of the office. And there really couldn't have been a more favourable circumstance, because the Secretary of State at that time, Hilary Benn, is a vegetarian. And I literally mean the paper got circulated, and within, nobody talked about it, and then it just died. And that's the kind of level of debate that didn't take place there. And that's how certain things... So the reflection there is that certain things are just too far a political jump. Second reflection is one of zeitgeist. And I've heard a number of people here talk about regulation is a good approach and a preferable approach to behavioural change. But you've got to think about where this government is at this moment in time. And I used to lead something called the Better Regulation Unit within DEFRA for a few years. And the makeup of this particular unit was consisting of a person from the NFU, a person from the CBI, a person from the Small Business Service, and a person from the Better Regulation Executive. I mean, notice who wasn't there. No academics, no NGOs. And as far as I'm aware, it was chaired by a minister and it had a fair bit of clout. The Sustainable Development Commission, on the other hand, no longer exists. Sorry, I mean, it's been mainstreamed. My mistake. So it is important to actually not be ignorant or unmindful of the fact that you know there's only certain... There's a political zeitgeist to things, and you need to sort of latch onto that. Third thing is, it's worth being patient. I mean, I think we heard a discussion earlier on about some of the public health issues. Some of these take a long time to happen, but when they do happen, they can be very conclusive. One of my former bosses, Jeff Mulgan, used to say, when you work in Whitehall, it's often incredibly depressing how slowly change happens. But often when you reflect on it, how when change does happen, it often beds in. And something like smoking, I think the first kind of academic research that showed the links between smoking and cancer took place in the 50s. The first kind of official ban, I think it was on a Swedish airline, took place around the same time, in the 50s and 60s. But before government could, government started raising taxes on it in the sort of 60s and 70s, it started being banned in the workplace in the 90s. And by the time it was actually banned in public spaces, that was just a formality. Government didn't really need to make the ban then. It already had permission to do that through behavioural changes. And really, you know, for quite some time now, amongst the polite society, smoking has just not been happening. So there's only so much could be done through regulation, and some things, when they bed in, they will bed in quite permanently. So it's worth being patient on this kind of thing. I'll reflect on one kind of interdisciplinary project I was involved with, because, well, they're few and far between, and, you know, the few times that they're there, just think about what made it a success. This was a project on the fish industry that I took part in the Cabinet Office, in the strategy unit there. And fish policy is dysfunctional at many, many different levels. It's a devolution issue in the sense that half the fishermen are based in Scotland while the policy is made in London. It's an unenforceable policy in the sense that there's something like 10,000 fishermen and only a few hundred fishermen inspectors, and frankly, the size of water they're meant to patrol is the size of the UK in waterways. There's a European issue because this common fishery policy is argued in Europe. It's a trust issue in the sense that most fishermen don't actually believe the science, and so they don't actually get or accept the kind of quotas and the kind of evidence base that the fishermen are providing. And lastly, the fish stock are collapsing, which is a reason for immediate concern, and also the ecosystems are totally being buggered by trawling. So this is a policy that is really not working at many, many different levels. And what we did there was actually comprise a team of about five people. One was a fisheries biologist who was sitting there with computer simulations of fishery stocks and actually doing the modelling. The second was an MBA who knew a bit about profit and loss figures and could look at the balance sheet of the fishing industry and add value to it. The third was a kind of a fisheries economist and thought about the enforcement actions and the kind of the way that tradable quotas and all this kind of stuff work. And the last one was a professional Scot. He actually had a quilt and everything. So basically we had all angles covered. And the reason it worked was... we were tightly knit in the sense that we were physically in an area of space this big. We had no option but to sit and talk to each other. We had a respect for one another's abilities, or rather we were so ignorant about one another's skills that we couldn't argue effectively against them. And we were all pretty good. I mean, it did gel, but it happens very few and far between. Unfortunately, the reality in Whitehall is that there's actually a bit of a pecking order amongst the scientific disciplines. And you know, the economists tend to have more status than the social researchers, than the statisticians, and even sadly the scientists. So I think one of the tricks is actually to think about that kind of relative pecking order within Whitehall and try to, you know, form your arguments accordingly. So those are my kind of reflections on policy. A bit about behavioural science or behavioural economics. I slightly disagree with what Bronwyn says. I mean, within government now, this is a big zeitgeist thing. And I work in Consumer Focus, which has kind of taken over the National Social Marketing Foundation. And the social marketing people are very fond of saying the behavioural economics is just the same as them. what they've been doing for like 30 years. Well, there's actually two crucial differences, social and marketing. Because unfortunately, social pisses off the Conservatives and the Tories, mm-hmm. and marketing pisses off the Labour. So as a sort of statement of political acceptability, it kind of it's getting it from both sides. Whereas behavioural economics, it might be the same ideas repackaged, but it's actually in a more presentationally effective way. It's got word economics in, which makes it sound credible, and it has behaviour in, which makes it sound as if it's not hurting too much. And slightly disagreeing with you, Bronwyn, at least the belief within Whitehall is that there is less political cost because you're not ramping up taxes on industry. And it sort of ticks the better regulation ones because, in a way, there's always the opt-out and it's not actually making people do anything. They've always got to, it's just this, nudge. So I think it is actually worth sort of latching onto this. And just this idea of rebranding. I mean, the good thing about Resolve was it's such a great term, Resolve. I like it so much. The research group on lifestyle values and environments. I'm absolutely delighted from what Julia said about the reincarnation of the group through the Sustainable Lifestyle Group. And Sustainable Lifestyle Group, SILGO, sounds a bit Irish. I mean, do think about what you're going to call it, because I think something like Go Slow or Slogo or something like that might work. So, market yourselves. That's part of social marketing too. Thanks very much.
Thank you all very much. That was terrific. Very provocative as well in the style of Julia too. A lot of points of resonance. I've picked up three points really. One is about translation between and within disciplines, and from academic work into community life, and from academic work into political life. Second, agreement or disagreement on the terms of engagement that we have in establishing a common language. When we're trying to translate findings and ideas into practice. And the third one is about being realistic about expectations in all these different contexts, whether they're academic or the interface between academic life and policy and communities. So we might want to pick some of those up, but it's over to you now. What we'll do is take three questions at a time. You can direct them at single members of the panel or at the panel as a whole, or indeed at each other. So we've got just over half an hour. Let's get going. So let's take three. Please, sir, at the front there.
Kevin Birchall at Kingston University. Well, I work in a small research group populated by